The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk with Mastercard.
Have you ever considered what you'd like your family to do if you happen to be in an accident that leaves you in a coma or a vegetative state? Well, it's not something that most people consider or even want to think about, but my next guest has spent a lot of time both personally and professionally dealing with the issue. Her name is Jenny Kitzinger. She is Professor of Communications Research at Cardiff University and co-directs the Coma and Disorders of Consciousness Research Centre. She joins me on the line from London ahead of her appearance at the Forum on End of Life, run by the Irish Hospice Foundation at Dublin Castle next Tuesday. Jenny, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
Now, it's an area that, I have to tell you, most people don't want to even think about, never mind talk about.
Yes, there is a huge taboo and fear and superstition about talking about these issues. But unless we do, we risk actually leaving ourselves and our families vulnerable to, well, maltreatment, really.
Now, sometimes when someone is diagnosed with dementia at an early stage, while they're still capable of looking after themselves, but they've begun to lose memory and become a bit absent-minded, they are persuaded to, at that point, address the issue of what used to be called a living will. There's another term for it now. But, you know, this kind of thing where people become mentally incapacitated can happen really at any age.
Yes, I mean, it's estimated that one in three of us will face the end of our lives unable to make decisions. And that can be from a car crash in your 20s with devastating brain injury or extreme dementia in your 80s. So I think this applies to all of us. And it applies whether or not you know and have the support to face a degenerative condition such as dementia.
Now, you came to this personally through what happened to your sister Polly.
Yes, Polly was a disability rights advocate, and she was on her way back from a conference talking about the human rights of people who couldn't speak for themselves, to have their voices respected. And ironically, she was in a head-on car crash, and at that point lost capacity to make her own decisions. And she had not filled in an advanced decision and signed it, which is what you can do under English law, which is why I feel so passionately about the advanced healthcare directives in Ireland and the advanced decisions in England and Wales.
What was the impact of not having written down what she would like to happen to herself in this kind of situation? Because she had, obviously, as many people do, talked about it informally.
Yes, she'd talked about it. She'd written poems about it. And we had letters where she talked about it. But we were told that under English law, neither us as next of kin could make the decisions for her, nor could her prior expressed wishes be determinative of the treatment plan. So the clinicians made their own decisions, guided by their own clinical judgment or their own moral framework, or frankly, their own kind of institutional needs. So she received treatment, life-sustaining treatment, that she would not have wanted.
Now, what sort of ways did it, does it affect the way she lives?
She continues to survive in a state of 24/7 care, unable to make her own decisions, clearly experiencing some pain and distress. And it's not a condition she ever would have wanted to be sustained in, and that's how she will live for the rest of her life. And as a family, we are dedicated to trying to both hear, make sure her voice is heard, and also do what little we can to improve her quality of life in the now. But it's a hugely painful situation for everybody.
Now, sometimes in the case of elderly people, they will ask, you know, what is the decision that is to be made in the case of, say, a catastrophic stroke in an elderly person, which will incapacitate them further? And often they ask, you know, about the DNR, do not resuscitate instruction. You know, who can make that decision for someone who's mentally incapacitated?
Well, it's actually a doctor's decision whether or not to offer a treatment and whether it is futile. So it's possible for doctors to go, well, I don't think this would do any good. It would simply prolong dying and break your ribs in the process. But in England and Wales, they're meant to certainly consult with the family. And that's a bit different from what's called a best interest decision, which is a decision which brings together the clinical information about, you know, the balance of the costs and benefits of a certain intervention and what the person themselves would want. And that's a much more sort of sophisticated decision-making process, I think, whereas clearly some treatments are futile. They're just not going to work clinically.
And the doctors will make that appropriate decision. But if you've got a situation where, for example, you don't know really what someone wants of their situation, and where the nursing home says, well, we could do with this bed. So let's not hydrate this person. Let's not, feed this person properly, and eventually nature will take its course. That's a worry that some people might have, which is the opposite worry to the one that you've been reflecting on.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's illegal and wrong and unjust. And it's not actually the opposite problem. To me, the key thing here is what would the person want, and they should have the right support and the best possible care that means they're neither given treatment they would not want nor deprived treatment that they would want. So it's exactly the same thing, actually, and it's about the rights of the individual.
In terms of your own mother, she had a different situation and a happier outcome.
Yes. I mean, I think this is one of Polly's legacy for our family, that we were all so horrified by the way Polly's rights were taken from her, that we all wrote advanced decisions, and we also rapidly appointed each other in the family with something called lasting power of attorney, which is where you can give somebody that you trust the responsibility and power to make decisions for you. And so we had that all in place by the time my mother both developed early dementia, but also then had a stroke and had cancer and had a combination of issues she had to face. And what was, I guess, rather lovely about that, for all the grief, is that as a family, we were fully able to support Sheila to make all the decisions that she could, insofar and to the extent that she could. And then when she couldn't make decisions, to stand up for her. And she had the best possible kind of death that she could have under the circumstances. And that's a gift. That's a gift both to Sheila, but also to the family she leaves behind.
She was a campaigner herself?
Oh, yes. She was a great campaigner for women's rights in childbirth. And to say that women should be able to make choices, informed choices, and be supported to do childbirth in the best way for them, and that they shouldn't be forced to lie on their back with their legs in stirrups and have an episiotomy and an enema, which was common in the kind of 1960s. So she helped transform that.
And rather humorously described how she would one day, in earlier years, how one day she would like to die.
She was invited to write her own obituary for a newspaper, and she wrote a lovely story where she imagined dying at a conference on the platform while lying on her back with her feet in the air, grunting to demonstrate how not to give birth. So she imagined a wonderful death at a conference. She didn't have that one, sadly, but she was writing her autobiography right to the end. As she was dying, we were reading to her the proofs of her autobiography.
And in terms of even her burial and all of that, or her funeral service, that was controlled as well, because you knew what she wanted because she told you.
Well, controlled might be a slight exaggeration for the kind of having to do that. But she just not long before she died, she said, you know, I want you girls to bury me. I don't want a funeral parlour. I don't want professionals involved. You can do it. Just give me a woodland burial somewhere. And then she died just before midnight on a Saturday. And she'd also said she wanted to be buried within 24 hours. So we had to kind of rather quickly sort out everything from the cardboard coffin to how we could fit her in the back of a polo car and get a digger to dig a hole. She kept us busy. And I think, you know, she liked setting us challenges. And so I look back on it with some amusement. But I have to say it was a little challenging at the time. But it does feel good to have again respected her wishes, done things the way she wanted.
But the fundamental thing, you're campaigning so that more people will be aware of what they should do and be wary of what might happen to them if they don't.
Yeah, I mean, if you want other, if you Many of us will lose capacity to make our own decisions. Now, if you're happy for others just to guess what you'd want, you don't need to do anything. That's fine. If you'd actually like other people to know what you'd like, both for their own sake and for yours, then think about it, talk about it, and write an advanced healthcare directive where people can refer to that piece of paper, and it'll help them make decisions when you're not able to.
Jenny Kitzinger, Professor of Communications Research at Cardiff University and Co-Director of Coma and Disorders of Consciousness Research Centre. Thank you very much. Now, Jenny will be speaking at Dublin Castle next Tuesday, the 10th of October, at the Forum on End of Life, which is run by the Irish Hospice Foundation. This year's theme is Your Life, Your Death, Your Say. You can register for the event at hospicefoundation.ie or by calling Dublin 679 3188. That's Dublin 679 3188.